Hello, I'm Jack DeRose, CEO and founder of Colony.
And I'm Aaron Fisher, recovering mathematician and the co-author of the Colony white paper.
Hello, I'm Commodore, working on product at Colony and obsessed with DAO governance.
And this is Collectively Intelligent, the podcast in which we hope that if we talk to smart people for long enough, we might eventually say something intelligent.
We have Chrono on the podcast, and I'd love for you to introduce yourself and what you work on.
Hi, everyone. My name is Daniel Kronovet. I go by Chrono. I'm a research engineer on the Colony team. I've been at the team for 3 years now. I have a background in political economy and also math and computer science. And, what I do at Colony is sort of designing decision-making mechanisms and tools and working on a lot of the smart contract base is like very much like my jam and my passion. So I'm very stoked to be part of this team. I'm very stoked to do what I do. I'm very stoked to be able to think about these questions all the time. It's like overall a great situation, and I'm just very happy to be here, and I'm very happy to be on this podcast.
Cronin and I were talking, and he was telling me a little bit about Stafford Beer and some of these experiments that he did. And so I wanted to have him on the podcast and talk about those experiments and then some of the insights that he's extracted from that. What is Stafford Beer? What did he work on? What's the story?
100%. So Stafford Beer was a British cyberneticist, management theorist, one of those real great 60s, 70s kind of utopian tech types. I think we can take Buckminster Fuller and put him in that category. So one of those. And so he was very much out there into computers, into technology, thinking about ways we could use technology to support and develop, you know, more complex ways of running organizations and doing things. He wrote an amazing paper called Designing Freedom. It's actually a series of lectures where he talks all about like the theory of cybernetics and why the computer is so important. And more importantly, the right way to use the computer. And he had a lot to say about the right and the wrong way to leverage computation to aid and provide more freedom. He makes the point that if you use the computer naively, it'll actually be experienced in a very repressive or restricting way. But if used correctly, it can be a very liberating and poetic thing. And so he talks about what that means. Something else I love about Stafford Beer was, so in Chile in the 70s, during the Pinochet administration, this was a socialist government, very visionary, very forward-thinking. And they recruited him to develop a suite of tools to basically manage the government. It was called CyberSyn, and it was quite visionary at the time. It was different tools for gathering economic data, for visualizing it, rendering it in real time, allow the government to basically have a say and have oversight over the state. It was an attempt to achieve an effective socialist government in a way that had never been done before, by recognizing that ultimately information processing is the bottleneck of socialism. There's a great essay by Friedrich Hayek called The Use of Knowledge in Society, where he talks all about this. It's actually a very interesting essay. I would recommend anyone to read it who's interested in these topics. His argument, this is a small sidebar, is the reason why capitalism is so effective is because prices allow for distributed computation to occur in the society. And communist governments that ultimately do things in a top-down way just don't have access to the information that they need to make good decisions. And basically, Stafford Beer was like, that was true in the 30s and the 40s, but we have computers now. So why can't we have more effective ways of gathering information that allows for effective sort of oversight and control in a way that could never be done before? That was the vision. So as we all know, that administration did not last very long, and so that vision was never realized. But there's an idea here, there's a sort of a tradition here of using computation and computers to give us better information, to do a lot of information processing for us, and then allow us to develop better kinds of organizations. That's a tradition that I think that we're in. We can talk about whether we want to be socialist or capitalist, and that's not really what this is about. It's about developing new ways of using computation to create better tools to allow us to develop new and more effective organization in whatever way we want to deploy them. So I think that's really the tradition that Stafford Beer was in, the tradition that I would say we are in, which I think is pretty exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that I was trying to understand a little bit, there was this kind of quote in there around freezing the continuous variables into these kind of arbitrary time pieces, and then conducting our business in a way that is like, I'm thinking about quarters and how do we plan and how do we execute? Like, how does that idea play with this kind of computing at the edges, or does it not play at all?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think this is really at the core of what Safford Beer was saying. And I would really say at the core of what I think Colony is doing really well, I would say their core sort of competency, they're one of the parts that the core part of the vision. So Safford Beer's point was saying that when you take a snapshot of resources, there's this much money in the bank, this is our stock portfolio, whatever, he's saying this is a very static way of looking at an organization. And it's really not effective for governing, right? It's a way to let, you know, a rich person get a sense of their assets. It is not a good way to run a business. And his point, and this is a cybernetic idea, is that what we really care about are flows of resources over time. It's not that every 3 months, this is where the money is. It's every day, this is where the money is going. This is where the resources are being consumed. This is what's happening. And you need to be able to ultimately see in real time, in a dynamic way, where resources are flowing. And that's the information that you need to be able to effectively govern and control. That was his core insight.
I see. Yeah. And I think the pricing that you talked about, using the prices as the conduit to do the information processing, like the prices are basically being determined by the actual agents at the edges. And so that's a component of it. Or you wouldn't necessarily set prices perhaps on a quarterly basis or an annual basis. I suppose you could, but it really stinks of like top-down organization and running that as opposed to out of the edges. Is that a fair encapsulation as well?
That is a fair encapsulation. I think another way to say it is the sort of a free market based on variable prices was the first, it was the first time that we were able to successfully achieve a kind of dynamic economy, right? Like the notion of a price set in the market as a way of communicating information, I would say that was the first time we were able to achieve this sort of dynamic goal. And I think it remains an exemplary example. Like, I'm very pro markets. I think that they're an incredible invention. I think that they do a lot of amazing work. But I think so that was the first time we were able to pull this off. Now we ask ourselves, what's the next way we're going to do this? Can we move beyond prices and understand other things in a dynamic way, such as the flow of assets?
Right.
Not simply the price of something at a given moment in time.
What I love about that is in our snapshot of living in this era, it's, yeah, this is probably the best way. But I think if you fast forward 500 years, 1,000 years, 10,000 years, it's like, clearly we're going to have figured out more interesting mechanisms to understand all these different variables. And I do think of all of the downsides of capitalism. Are those the things that you're unable to measure within with a price? And you kind of carbon credits come to mind. It's like this idea of carbon credits really wasn't around a long time ago in terms of being anywhere close to being implemented. But this idea of understanding that, measuring that, capturing that, building a market for it, I think really wasn't captured in the raw capitalist idea of how we were pricing emissions, for example, in there. So what I'm taking away from what you're talking about here is add computers into this pricing piece, and what other ways can we structure and process the world and govern it, which is super, super interesting.
Correct. And something else I would say on top of that is, how can we bring more information to bear, right? The price of something is important information. No one will deny it. I think it's amazing. But there's other kinds of information that we might want access to, that we might want to include in our decision making that we don't currently have access to. So what if we had access to price, but also political priorities, but also resource stocks, but also like maybe subjective measures of happiness and well-being? We had access to all of these things together, and now we can make decisions that are a bit more holistic than based on price alone. How can we get more information that is dynamic, giving us overall a better sense of what's going on?
Absolutely. And do you think this is kind of bridging a little bit into the Colony and Web3 world, but do you think like DAOs are a path to that, or they're just a space in which we're tackling kind of early elements of that? Like, how do you think about DAOs and that opportunity?
It's a great question. I really love being a part of the DAO space. Like, I really do feel like this is a sort of a historical moment, in that we are part of a tradition governance. And I think that's an important thing to really acknowledge, that this is a tradition of developing new ways to live and work together that is really important. And if we look back hundreds, thousands of years, like this is where a lot of the action happens. And I don't think it's too much to say that's what's happening now. So I think that we're all playing a small role. I don't want to, you know, build us up too much, but I think that what's happening broadly with DAOs and the crypto scene is like a historical thing, which I think is pretty cool. Like, I think that's cool. Not everyone gets to be a part of that. So that's awesome. And we can acknowledge that that's a cool thing. That said, it's hard. We don't know what's going to happen. It's a very experimental time. A lot of ideas, a lot of experiments. It's not quite clear how it's all going to shake out. It's not quite clear what like the vision is. But it's definitely, it's all happening in the words of an almost famous and amazing film. But I think to build on that, I think that what I think we're seeing a couple things happening at the same time. I think on one end, I think that we are taking conventional best practices and putting it on the chain, quote unquote. So I think that's right. the beginning, like that's less experimental, more like bread and butter. Let's take existing practices and implement them using a new technology. Let's get that foundation out of the way. Now we have best practices available in this new sort of technology world, which is a very important step to take. So like that step is being taken. And then we have, let's experiment with new mechanisms. Okay, let's not worry about best practices. Let's talk more about new practices. And that's more risky, more experimental, a little bit more, I don't know, let's try it out. This seems like a good idea, but we don't know what we're talking about. We do, but also we don't. But let's try it out. This is an experimental time, right? This is the time to do it. So right. That's happening. And so so that's also, I think those are two maybe streams. And then, teams develop projects. They have their ideas. They put them into practice. People try them. Some things are successes. Some things are not successes. And this whole sort of scene is where all these things are developing. And how it'll all shake out is obviously TBD, but I think there are a lot of cool things happening. And I think every experiment is valuable information for everyone else. And I'm like overall very optimistic about this whole thing.
I totally agree with that. And I think there's this piece that there's plenty of experimentation on how to organize humans from a company perspective. And there's been a lot of experimentation over the last 50 plus years. But I feel like what crypto has enabled is this sort of, you're obviously able to codify things. You have these tokens, you have all of these different elements that are fundamentally different. And then you have still humans trying to organize in there. And so it feels like you now have this creative space for say, hey, we actually can do a lot here. Before, I had to think about organization as it related to most likely physically being near each other, or at least the idea of the physical entity and interacting with each other. I had to think about using USD as the currency that we interacted with. I had to think about US law or whatever my local nation state's law was to be able to structure this thing. And I feel like we've just moved into maybe not a new first principles approach of it, but we have first principle, gleamings of being able to say, wait a second, like, how do I want to incentivize everyone to be a part of this? How do I want to run a currency through this? What if I can just throw away a lot of the pre-existing structures and rebuild? And I think that's probably part of the reason that we're seeing this explosion of experimentation, which is to your one of your points you made there is like, hey, we'll probably look back at this. And this is certainly an era of a transition shift. I don't know how long it exactly took for the industrial revolution to kick in, but it probably took a while and we're probably somewhere in that change.
Yeah, no, I would definitely agree.
And you talked a little bit about like some of that thinking and how it's applied to the colony world. And I'm not necessarily trying to have you on here just to pitch all the amazing, interesting things about colony, but how has that kind of framed some of your thinking about what are some of the features or tools that you're able to fiddle with, maybe from a colony agnostic perspective, but from like a mechanism perspective?
Sure. It's a great question. And I think that the most important thing that I would want to impress upon the audience that I would say is important to introduce, that really computers let us introduce, is the notion of time as a sort of underlying, I don't want to say mechanic, but let's say like time as an underlying mechanic, right? Time as driving the system forward. Things are happening over time, independent of what any individual person is doing. I think that's like the key novelty here, is that we can have, the computer has a clock, and so the clock is always running, and so things are always happening, always changing, independent of what any individual person does. Now, and I'll contrast this with a more sort of a traditional way of doing things that are, someone proposes a motion, people vote, it passes or fails. That's all person-driven, right? Someone has to initiate every action, and unless someone initiates an action, the system is static. Whereas when you introduce the time elements, all of a sudden now the system is never, like the system at rest is actually always changing, right? Without individual interaction, the system is still moving and evolving. And I think that is the key insight. Colony aside, where I see this happening is with, for example, conviction voting, which is an idea that's being introduced elsewhere. The idea that when you commit to a vote, the longer that your vote is held, the more value it acquires. The idea being the longer that you hold a conviction, the more sort of real or valuable or tested it is. And so, yeah, so that's an idea, right? So another group of people that are saying, hey, time actually lets us do new kinds of things that we think are actually very important, right? So I think that every single way that we can use time as an underlying driver of the action, I think is something that is worth exploring. I could also say Colony does this in a number of ways, and I can go into the details of what and how and why. We can do that later. But I think broadly, that is something that I'm very excited about. And I think going back to Stafford Beer, that was his whole thing, right? It's, things are happening over time, right? Things are changing over time. Time is always there in the background making things happen. And I think that is like the top level insight and perspective that we have to have going into this, going into these new technologies. It's like basically my thesis.
Yeah, and I think what I'm hearing in that is it's the connection of time to like computing things in that time. And so I'm thinking about there was like in the 2020 election, there was a lot of when do we ratify the electoral votes, and that those were human energy had to be injected in the system for humans to go do a particular action and do those things. But what I'm hearing you say is if you think about time as a feature and then you can assign functions to that, then you can decay things, you can do things like staking, like you talked about the conviction voting, where the thing actually gets stronger as time goes on, or it goes weaker as time goes on, or a particular function happens if Y amount of results don't occur. And so you can bake time and tie it together with computation.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think time is driving the action, right? Time, like going back to the election, it was a schedule. It was the election, and then there's the ratification, and there's the Senate does something, and then there's a riot, and then there's the inauguration. There was a schedule, and that drove the action. So yeah, I think that's a good way to think about it.
And then reputation is something that I think a lot about, and the Colony has made a strong kind of opinion around how reputation works and how it decays. How do you think about reputation broadly and how that fits into some of this thinking?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think reputation systems are extremely interesting. I actually wrote an essay on them some years ago, which I'm happy to add to the show notes because I thought it was decent.
Yeah,
reputation is an important topic. I think that what I could say, there's two things I want to say about reputation. The first is that when reputation is made explicit, you can use it for more things, right? So explicit reputation is preferable over implicit reputation, all else being equal. That said, explicit reputation has so many pitfalls that it's often better not to make it explicit. It's the kind of thing that is so difficult to accurately measure that sometimes it's better not to do it and to have it just be informal, like people talk, so-and-so is good, is bad. You know, don't assign a number just because that number is going to be wrong.
Right.
That said, if you can assign a number properly, then you should, because all of a sudden so many things become possible. So that's like the tragedy of reputation, or like the central sort of conflict. I think that if we want to talk about how do we go about making reputation explicit, I think that the first kind of insight is that the more specific the reputation is, the better. I think that the problem is when you try to get into these very general, abstract reputation scores that are trying to capture very subjective qualities, someone's quality as a person. I think those kind of things are very fraught. But I think if you can make it very specific, then you're getting into less of a problem, right? I think there's a sort of notion that there's something called Goodhart's Law. It's like one of these laws that gets bandied around. And the basic idea is that when you start to measure something, it puts pressure on the measurement. And so the measurement is distorted, right? We can think of a classic example as being like standardized testing, right? Like we want to measure student achievement. But all of a sudden, now that we're measuring something, this whole industry of test prep and like that measurement becomes distorted because now it's a proxy for wealth, right? Like we understand what's happening. And so that's true obviously in reputation as well. When you make something explicit, all of a sudden now you can make it gain. Mm-hmm. So this is the risk. The more specific you make the measurement, the harder it is to game and the more useful it will be. I think that is the thing that we have to keep in mind. And so as a small example, China is doing social credit, which is a reputation system. And they're experimenting with this, and you know, and I was doing some research into this, and it's interesting because it's actually done in a very local way, where some cities will do it one way, and some cities will do it another way. And what they found was that cities that make it very like specific like you ran a red light, you lose 5 points, or paid your taxes on time, you get 5 points. That was actually very well received because people appreciated having a little bit more sort of structured enforcement over very commonly agreed upon, like, behavioral norms. It was the cities that did it very, like, I like tried to be very visionary and came up with a single score of like how good you are as a person that incorporates all these things. People were not having it. They're like, these scores are useless. They're not helpful. They're wrong. This is the problem, right? So I think that is a good sort of example of how reputation that is the most specific is the most useful because it's the least wrong, right? Like, it's always going to be wrong a little bit, but you want it to be as least wrong as possible. And so the more specific it is, the better. I think that is broadly what I have to say about this topic.
I'm thinking of sports, and I apologize to you sports for our listeners, but I think of you have measurements of how fast does this person run this particular distance, and you might use that during a combine process of evaluating potential talent. And then I think of, you really don't hear any debates about that on a, you know, sports talk, talking heads, a radio show or something like that, right? It's just like, this person is in fact faster than that person. And then you can do things with that and say, okay, this athlete is faster than that athlete. But if you move up a few layers of abstraction and say, who's the better player? And, you know, the US, Michael Jordan versus LeBron James, and who's the greater player of all time? It's like this debate goes on constantly in a million different talk shows, a million different people. And it makes me think a little bit about this reputation piece. It's they're trying to measure this very immeasurable thing, packing in a ton of different variables, who's won, who's had better teammates, who's had more adversity, and all this crap. And then that's what causes this 50-50 debate that rages on incessantly. And so what I'm hearing a little bit in this journey is, yes, if you can narrow it down to just speed as an example, like we can actually then start doing a lot more interesting things from there on out instead of wasting all of our time with this like inefficient, yes, there's two athletes, who's better than another? I don't know. It doesn't actually really matter. And I feel like there's so many problems that if you were building a governance system on top of that, how could you get anything done with that or social credit or whatever it may be? These serious issues as opposed to just entertainment-based seems, I totally buy that. It could be very difficult.
Yeah, I think that's a great example. And I think that's exactly right.
You talked a little bit about how Colony, you know, it becomes a cybernetic system. Can you try to outline what that actually would mean?
What I mean when I say that is that because so many mechanics are time-based, the colony is always evolving independent of what any single person is doing. And so the colony becomes sort of its own entity that every participant interacts with. So the colony is almost like a living thing that we are all interacting with and affecting, but it has its own, I don't want to say essence because that's like a little bit dramatic, but it has its own liveness to it that is the sum of all the small interactions of individual people. And something about that I really like is that it means that any individual person can interact with it on their own terms. And this is something that I really like about this project. And I think what I like about it in contrast with more like motions and voting based approaches, where any individual person can show up and make marginal changes to the colony. They can make a marginal claim on resources. They and a few others can do some marginal work at the periphery. And you have a lot of people interacting. You know, the sort of the origin of the colony name comes from the ant colony. And the idea that you have a lot of individual actors that are all doing their own thing without really paying much attention or needing to know holistically what's going on with the entire organization. But the sum of all of those local actions end up being quite complex. That was the original vision. And I think a design that allows people to individually interact with the colony is really the point of the project. And I think that is pretty compelling.
Is it crazy to think that some of the Stanford beer thinking and thinking about how he was trying to actually plan and organize nation state level governance and existence, thinking about Colony as a cybernetic system. Is it crazy to think that Colony could be some form of a blueprint to think about how a nation state or the idea formerly known as a nation state might govern itself? Is that too far of a leap?
No, I don't. I think that we're definitely not there yet. But I think to zoom out, I think the spirit of this whole sort of time we're in is to experiment with new ways of doing things. I think that to say, look, we have some tools that we are successfully applying at small scales. Can we apply them at larger scales? Like, maybe. Like, I'm really an incrementalist. I really believe in small incremental changes. And I think that trying out a new idea at a small scale, seeing if it works, trying it on a bigger scale, seeing if it works, is a very reasonable way to do things. But yeah, if it turns out that a lot of these tools are very valuable and people love them, then there's no reason why we can't say, hey, let's do the same thing, but like bigger. Let's do the same thing, but bigger. And like, why not? So there's no reason why these tools can't scale, or like we can scale them up until we hit a wall and then we'll learn what the issue is and we'll deal with it then. But there's no, yeah, there's no reason why these ideas couldn't just be scaled up for a long time.
And this is a crazy tangent, and feel free to go down the rabbit hole with me or not. Do you see a world where post kind of crypto and Web3 fully hitting its vision, a world where the nation states as we see them today still exist in that structure? Or do you see some of the work that's going on in Web3 and in governance and broadly as being a new path for how we organize human beings at a societal scale?
I think there's two things I would want to say. One, I think that we do have to think a lot about, I think we have to be like realists, political realists. And political realists are always thinking about security. I think it's one thing to have a bunch of fuzzy sort of international communities that are all linked up via the internet. But what does that mean from the perspective of like borders and military force? I think at the end of the day, it's like the reason why we have countries is because they're useful. I was reading some essay which made the great point, or this honestly might have been a tweet, basically saying that countries are ultimately security communities, right? Mm-hmm. This is a group of people, and ultimately the point of a country is to provide security to everyone living inside the country against people outside of the country. And that's just like true, and we don't think about it until the security is lost, and that's all that we think about. But that's something that we really do have to keep like kind of on the table mentally as we're thinking about these things, right? Like we can't, if we lose the ability to provide physical security, then we're gonna get eaten up. It's not like, it's not gonna work. So like, we can't ever forget that. So yes, maybe crypto will provide a replacement to countries and nation states, but it'll have to provide security along the way. Right. So like, this, keep that in mind. The second thing though, is, and there's a, so you've all know Harari, he's the guy that wrote Sapiens, Homo Deus, cool guy, I'm a fan of his work. He wrote an essay in The Guardian maybe 3 years ago that really affected me. Basically, he was talking about religion and capitalism basically as types of games. And his whole idea was everything is a game, and we can use like the lens of gaming to understand a lot of different forms society has taken. And he said, religion is a game where you get points by doing good deeds. And if you win, when you die, you like get a good outcome. Right? So, like, religion is a game. Let's like break it down. Here's a bunch of things that you should do. If you do them, you're going to win. If you don't do them, you're going to lose. Right?
Right.
Go nuts. And honestly, that worked pretty well for a long time. It also didn't work very well for a long time. But like, we can acknowledge that that had a lot of things going forward that were very effective in certain ways. So that was that. He's like, capitalism, a game, right? There's dollars or points. You like get dollars, either you can be, there's like entrepreneurial ways of getting dollars, which are high risk, high reward. There's working jobs ways, which are low risk, low reward. There's different strategies for playing capitalism the game. By the end of the day, the person with the most dollars wins the game. Mm-hmm. Right? So look, these are just different games that we provided people to play so that we could all organize into a nice society where everyone knew what they were doing. We gave them feedback, we gave them goals, we gave them meaning and identity. That's what it is. He's look, like we could just make new games. Right? Like you could just make a different game that just has different rules, that has different outcomes. But like his conclusion was that like talking about games is not some like radical new, like stupid thing. It's actually what we've been doing for a long time. So let's just call it what it is. And let's be like, all right, like that's what's happening. We can do it again differently. So I think that is important to think about. And so then going back to crypto, what way can we use these new mechanics to create new kinds of quote-unquote games, new kinds of interactions, new kinds of incentive structures, new ways to develop identity, new ways of feeling progress and growth, right? How can we create new kinds of games that are more effective at A, giving people meaning, helping them find connection, effectively managing resources, dealing with conflict, right? We can definitely do that. The design space of games has not been fully explored. And does crypto give us new tools to develop new games, quote-unquote? The answer is like, probably.
What I resonate with that is I was thinking about religion, and I will spare yourself and the audience for us going too far down the religion rabbit hole. But yeah, that gamification of it, I totally buy it, especially in certain religions. Are there more gamed than others? Others are flatter and others are taller. in whatever it may be. But it's interesting to think about crypto as it relates to a sense of belonging in a community and in working your way up. And you hear a lot about the decline of religion and the modern society. And I saw a posit that was, hey, CrossFit is an example. It's like an outlet that wouldn't have existed in the highly religious era because it is a sense of community, a sense of purpose. You go there and you do these actions. And it's like these outlets, what are the businesses that are the outlets for where the religion or a church would have facilitated in not so long ago future? And I think crypto is this interesting little pocket that I would put in that CrossFit camp as well. So it's a place that is digitally native, which I think, especially with the pandemic and things of that nature, where people are even more locked in to their phones and their computers and being able to have access to it without kind of the distractions of real life, for lack of a better word, is that you can actually gamify and get and scratch that itch by joining a DAO and rising through the ranks and buying a token and earning tokens and trading those tokens and being NFTs and all these things. I think it's a really interesting conduit to your kind of point there, is that are we transferring some of the key games in our lives? And I would say right now they're predominantly aimless. There's sub goals and there's micro goals for each protocol or social token or whatever it may be. But could you gamify that entire existence now that we have digital native tools to build that game? That's pretty cool.
Yeah, 100%. I have two things I want to say because I love this topic. I think that there's something fun about crypto now, and maybe this is true about open source in general. I read a tweet maybe 2 weeks ago, and it said basically an entire generation of MMORPG addicts are designing the next wave of digital infrastructure.
Right.
And I was like, yeah, that sounds about right. That checks out. That's what's happening. Something else I want to say is I feel like, and maybe I'm like getting ahead of myself on this one because I don't know what I'm talking about, but forgive me. I'm the guest on the podcast, so this is what I think. I feel like we're in a very, it's like almost like, I feel like there's a really heroic nature to it where people want to be the ones to like make the big breakthrough. There's something maybe, and that's not true because, you know, there's also tremendous collaboration and tremendous like teamwork. But I feel like there's also, everyone wants to be the one or the team or the project to figure it out. There's a certain energy of like, everyone wants to be the one to do the thing. And I think that drives a lot of the action. And I think there's something very game-like about that. Everyone wants to be the one to make the thing, to make the discovery. And I guess this is true for science and creative pursuits in general. So I don't know if that's really that much of an insight. So anyway, maybe that's not a great point, but that's what I was thinking.
I think Twitter highlights it in the way that money flows to projects and whatnot. I think the two mechanisms, if you go back to research as an example, it's being referenced with the things that you're published and then getting more publicity. It's not all that different to your point.
Correct. The second point that I want to make though, is I think that we should be pretty humble. It's one thing to say society is a game, we can make new games, it's all well and good. But I think we should really appreciate and give serious sort of recognition to how difficult it is to create something that is compelling. And I think that going back to religion, I think we really, credit where credit's due. You know, I think like the major faiths really, a lot of people did a lot of work designing these things. I remember I was reading some history about early Christianity. You know, there was like Jesus was a figure who did a lot of amazing things. You know, but it wasn't until the apostles came along that the religion became really fleshed out. And I remember someone made the point that it was like Paul, I think, specifically, is like Paul had a gift for religion. Paul was a person who's like, I have some source material. I have Jesus. I have these stories. I have a lot of stuff here. But he was the one who said, I'm going to make a religion out of this. And he had a real gift and a genius for creating a whole sort of edifice around this character of Jesus that actually created an entire experience for people to live in and to occupy. And so, and also other people participated. It was like a whole process. And I think to say that we're just gonna come along and make a new game that is as compelling is like hubristic. You know, sure. I think that it can be done and it will be done. But I think acknowledging the achievements of the past as like achievements, I think is important. So I spent a lot of time thinking about Judaism through this lens of what is Judaism as a social system? What does it do emotionally? What does it do, you know, for people like emotionally, like economically? What is the mysticism and theology aside, like on the ground, what is happening? And I really, the more time I spend in these environments, the more I really appreciate like the song and like the tradition aspect and the food and like all of the pieces that were sort of put together over many hundreds of years by many very intelligent people. Say, this is the faith, and these are all the aspects of the faith, and how all these aspects come together to create a social, emotional, psychological experience that is compelling. I'm honestly really impressed. I'm like, this was a very impressive achievement that was done here. And yeah, so I think definitely there are more achievements to come, but I think really recognizing how impressive the achievements of the past were and realizing that our work is cut out for us and it's going to take a lot of time and a lot of people to make something that is as good, because now like we're in the post-religious moments, But I think really appreciating what those things were as like cultural achievements, I think is an important part of this process.
Yeah, I think I agree with you, but I'm going to throw out a hypothetical challenge to you and myself for that matter, because I think I agree with you. But is it a little bit of survivorship bias for us to post look back at these religions and say, oh, look, they figured out all these interesting things and they were able to organize people. And let's assume all good intent from the religions just as a precondition to make it simple. And they were able to accomplish these goals that they had set out to do and all these things. My kind of counterpause to it is there is like almost every single part of the world developed something. And is there almost something in our minds that sort of we have a human bias to symbolism and narrative, and let's just say a loss aversion is baked into us. So being able to tap into those elements of it, did they just naturally fall into all of our cognitive biases in general in the kind of one way that we could coordinate? And that's really the only way it could have been. Is that a fair counter?
This is a good point. I don't think there's the only way that it could have been. I think things could have been a lot of ways. I think also there were a lot of religions and faiths that didn't make it, right? So is it survivorship bias? Or is it natural selection for like good adaptation? And like those things are like related, right? There were a lot of people that had a lot of ideas for how to have different spiritual groups, and a lot of them imploded, a lot of them fizzled out, like a lot of them didn't have an important piece that was needed to make it last. And so the ones that came to us today had a lot of these things going on.
Right.
Were they lucky? Was it random chance? Was it just an accumulation of practices over a long period of time? Probably all these things, you know?
Yeah.
You know, I gotta honestly, this is a small sidebar, but I feel this way also about, for example, things like tarot or things like astrology, right? These are practices. So there's a cultural critic named Camille Paglia, who I really appreciate. And she writes a lot about art, history, and culture. And she has a great chapter about Shakespeare, and she talks about astrology. And she has a great line, which is basically what I'm paraphrasing, but she says, there are patterns that are visible to the eyes of the artist that are not visible to the scientist. There are things that artists can see that scientists, that science cannot. And like basically astrology has been in sort of continuous practice for thousands of years and has accumulated so much like one-off small pieces of insight. And it has let go things that haven't resonated. It has kept what has resonated. So now we'll be like, astrology is, this is stupid. But also at the same time, like thousands of years of people sort of slowly putting together this and that and this means this, and like things that didn't click were let go, and things that did click stayed. And really it's really, you know, this amazing cultural sort of heritage that continues to resonate with a lot of people. You can talk about the value of it, and I think a lot of people find it valuable, some people don't, fine. But it is something that has been collaboratively created for a long time, and I think that is worthy of some respect and recognition as a piece of art, which is what it is.
Yeah, that's a great closing element of that. As a piece of art, and you know, I don't think I can disagree with that. There's certainly it's a complicated thing, and I think there's I lean back into what are the kind of cognitive biases that we have, that we look for meaning in different things. We see faces in clouds and practices tapping into those things for us to force ourselves to do self-reflection. And is self-reflection healthy for us? That might have been a loop that was tapped into and figured out through a process of looking at the stars. And I think that's really powerful. My cynical side of my brain then goes to, what about the people that were slaughtered because the one star moved to the left of the other one, and they were murdered because of something I can't split those.
Commodore 1,000,000%. I think that brings us back nicely to like the current moment, where it's like, okay, like we can respect this sort of prior art for what it achieved. We recognize that it achieved it in a way that had many limitations. So we ask, like, where are we now? It's like, okay, we would like to achieve a similar type of thing that has a similar sort of impact and resonance, but in a way that avoids like the terrible limitations of what does that look like? How do you achieve the same sort of grandeur, poetry, art that we had before, but in a way that does not require or does not lean on so many of these harmful biases? That is how can we bring the spirit of enlightenment into like this tradition of these grand, emotionally resonant, like sort of cultural products?
Yes. Right?
What does that look like in a way that still has emotional resonance, still does valuable, like psychologically, like clarifying, but also has the values that we'd like to bring into the future that are more, what are the values? Like, it's not my place to say what the value, the right values are, but like, that's a conversation for another day. But the broadly enlightenment values, I think, are a fine place to start.
So thank you for pulling us back up one layer, and I'll pull us up one layer even further, which was your kind of fascination with the gaming mechanic. And you had shared briefly just like the idea of like, how could you apply some of these things to something like guild management? You just had some really awesome examples that I would love for you to share with the listeners of like how you would think about that, applying that.
Yeah. So there's two things to say. I think that I know what you're getting at, but I'll make another point first. I think that, so I find that game design as an art form very interesting. As a small aside, there's a great book called A Theory of Fun and Game Design by Raph Koster. I would really recommend it. It's really good. It talks a lot about what is a game, why are games fun, how do you design a good or compelling game. He writes a lot about this. I think he's very interesting. Everything.
I think
one way to look at it is that games are teaching tools, and a game provides an environment where cause and effect are easily understood, and someone can basically, it's clear what the actions available are. It's clear what the consequences of those actions are, and that allows someone to basically learn and grow in an environment that is somewhat constrained, where they can feel agency and competence. Mm-hmm. And I think that is something that is desirable. And there's also an aspect of learning how to play with others, which is very important for like emotional development, but that's not really what I'm talking about now, although right. It is. But I think, so going back to Colony, I think that going back to the thing about cybernetics, I think that creating a quote-unquote game where I can come into a colony and I can manage resources, I can do work, I can provide feedback, I can provide input over decisions. There's so many, the action space to the individual is so large beyond, oh, I have to vote on something, what are the current votes? But the action space is so much larger and the environment is always changing. So as a game where I can take actions and then have outcomes, and I can learn how to play, I think it's like very compelling and very exciting for people to be using the products. I'm very excited about. But also, this is almost a joke, but I thought like my favorite use case. I have this fantasy of a dispute in a colony being decided by an actual in-game duel. I really want this to happen. I'm really looking forward to bringing back duels as a way to do things, but like without actual death. I just really want like an actual like major resource decision to be made based on the outcome of an in-game duel and have it be like, you know, using crypto security. I just really want this to be something that happens. I think it's going to be so fun. Cause like, I really, at the end of the day, like I just want to be having a good time. I think everyone wants to be having a good time. I just think things be more fun than they currently are. And yeah. I just think these things can be more fun and but still effective. Let's be just as effective, but have things be more fun. And let's just do that. Like, that's what I want.
That would be a great way to solve some disputes. And I think that there are certain spaces too. It's not as crazy as it sounds. I think part of the origin of a duel was at that time, society really valued sort of athleticism and strength and creativity with a weapon. And they generally wanted the winner to win. So if you're fighting with swords and you were going to duel, it's like it was more advantageous to have the person who was better with the sword than the person that wasn't. And so there was like a utility trade there of, okay, they have a problem. Like society will back the one that is better there. And then muskets start, you know, changing that up a little bit with guns. And obviously we've gotten rid of duels now, but I could imagine, especially in a sports world or an esports world where you're like, hey, there's a dispute, like actually play a game of the sport that you're disputing about how you guys should do it. Or if there was, I'm thinking about those like Tamagotchis where you like build up those little characters, Digimons that like fight each other. And it's like, I spent hours building up my Digimon so that when I get in dispute, I'm going to win, right? Like, there's a bunch of interesting little micro applications that you can actually tie together. That's super cool.
100%. Like I think when I was younger, I was maybe more afraid of competition, but now that I'm like older and more mature, I like really appreciate it for what it is. It pushes people to be better. I think using like our ethical judgment to make decisions about these things is like still a good idea broadly.
Right.
But I think being able to play around with bringing in like aspects of fun competition as like a side value, I think is also fine. But I think that like juries of peers using ethical judgment is still more or less the way we should be doing things. But I think that, you know, having little bits of like fun competition mixed in is also, I think, probably a good thing.
I think like in high trust environments that have low consequences, I think duels make a ton of sense. I'm imagining my wife and I competing some duel to pick the show that we're watching tonight. It's like, I love her, she loves me. We're like, I'm happy watching what she wants, but there's an element there of fun. I imagine sports teams, you know, all these different areas. It's like, I wouldn't want anyone to, you know, determine whether or not they go to prison for the rest of their life on whether or not they win a VR match of some kind. But with your friends, with a low stakes thing, or even a high stakes thing, that is a relatively arbitrary thing. You could do this happens all the time in product management. It's like, hey, we should do product feature A or B, and the team gets to a split, and it's what do we should do, A or B, and the CEO or you flip a coin or whatever that process may be is relatively arbitrary in the big scheme of things. Who's to say it couldn't be solved with a tool? I'm all for it. We'll find the right applications over time.
100%. Can't wait.
I appreciate you joining the podcast. If you could remind people where to find you.
Yeah, sir. Of course. It was my pleasure. I had a great time. I love doing this sort of thing. So my name is Daniel. My handle is Chronosapiens. That's where I am normally found. So if on Twitter, I'm at Chronosapiens. Elsewhere, I'm pretty easy to find. But yeah, that's where you'll find me. My Twitter is mostly just quotes from things that I read, which I think if you're interested in that, if you want to know what I'm currently reading and what's interesting, like that could be useful for you. I've been told that my Twitter is actually pretty high alpha, which I found very flattering. That's where I'm at. Yeah. So that's where you'll find me.
What a quote. Love it. Thanks again for joining.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, Commodore. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the Collectively Intelligent Podcast. We'd greatly appreciate a review in your favorite podcast player. And if you want to stay in the loop even further, follow us on Twitter at @JoinColony. Thanks again.